Hey, everybody. Welcome to another Commission podcast. This is for 2003 nautical adventure war film, Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World.
I thought it was 1805. It's the year I was told.
Well, right. And you
looks
know,
great for an 1805 film.
Well, that's the thing. Peter Weir cheated. He actually teleported back to 1805 with high-definition cameras and filmed everything. You can't get more historical accurate than that. As I alluded to, Peter Weir directed this. It was adapted from the novelizations. There's 20 books by Patrick O'Brien called the Aubrey Maturin series.
How thick are those books?
They're anywhere from like 300 to 500 pages.
Okay.
I think the thickest book is the second one, oddly. It was adapted by Peter Weir and John Colley. I also want to shout out the cinematographer, which I accidentally forgot to write down his name. He is Russell Boyd, because one of the things I found in the research is that Peter Weir and Boyd and a couple of the other producers went on a like a partial circumnavigation on a replica of the HMS Endeavour.
Whoa.
Which was one of the first ships that that the famous Captain Cook sailed around the world. They actually did a rounding of the Horn, mm-hmm. as they showed. And the storm footage is actually footage that they shot on that thing. And then they digitally composited with their mock-up of the surprise that they had in this huge water gallon tank. It's the one they built for the Titanic in like Baja, Mexico, I think. But it's awesome. This is one of my favorite movies. We've got two commissioners to thank. It's a community commission podcast, but this was largely snapped up during our Save Bald Move campaign last year by Moz Beat and Stephen S. And I consider it a personal gift to me because this is one of my favorite movies, favorite book series. So I'm going to bypass my review.
I think you've talked a lot about this. Well, I want to say you've talked about how much you like it. I don't think you've talked much about it.
Right, because it's very...
Because I was surprised by it, I think.
Oh, okay. I would be interested to know what you think of it, Jim Jones.
I actually think it's great.
Thank God.
Yeah. This would be a real shit show if I hated it and you loved it. But I was surprised by... given what I've heard about it, I thought... So, A, I didn't know Russell Crowe was the star.
Oh, really?
I didn't know Paul Bettany was in it.
Mm-hmm.
Both of those guys I really like, and I'll talk about that in a second. But I was surprised by how, I guess, narrative-driven this movie was. I expected more of like a fictional documentary-style feel to it, with not a whole lot of plot, not a whole lot of characterization. And what I got was more like a traditional Hollywood film, which surprised me.
And
I don't know why it surprised me, but it must be based on something I heard about it.
You thought, I mean, I think what's interesting about Patrick O'Brien, the way he writes his books, is he was a big fan of British naval history. And he would read these, like, actual accounts of the battles in, like, the Naval Gazette, and then he would go and find, you can still find preserved, like, the captain's own notes of these engagements and their log entries of where the ships were and when they first made contact.
Yeah.
And he had this idea of, like, you know, holy hell, some of this stuff is amazing. I'm just going to write books and fictionalize the, you know, mix and match the best and the boldest. And then this movie is essentially a remixed version of some of the best parts of all 20 books. Like, the Wikipedia says it contains elements from 13 of the 20 novels.
Wow.
And like it plays like a highlight reel for a Patrick O'Brien guy, a fan such as I am. Hey man, it's such a big topic to get into. I'm surprised that you say that you didn't feel like it was a documentary, because the thing I was worried about is it's got a slow and deliberate pace to kind of like really get you in the mind of what it was like to be the sailor, to have those like few moments of terror punctuated by long stretches of boredom.
Absolutely. And the intro does really well to show you that.
But the things I thought that you would find interesting were like there's a little bit of Walking Dead in there where the threat of the environment is at least, if not more, dangerous than the enemy at hand.
Mm-hmm.
Like the fucking ocean will just kill you.
No, that storm scene was
terrifying.
Maybe the best scene of the whole movie, in my opinion.
And it's terrifying, and the fact that these guys are in this little wooden boat and they make one wrong mistake in seamanship and 200 people die and that's it.
Yeah, that's the thing. They say at the beginning, oh, it's got 28 guns, it's got 197 people, and I'm thinking, goddamn, this is like a horrible floating hotel that you can't leave.
Right.
Except the hotel may get shot up at any time by cannons.
Exactly. Or swept away in a typhoon.
Yeah.
The other thing I thought that you might like about it is that I've often heard this described as like the best Star Trek prequel of all time.
Okay. Yeah, totally.
Like
that,
if this
that
was
first...
the HMS Enterprise, you can immediately start saying, oh, they're on this voyage of discovery, but there's also hostile forces, but that's not the whole point, and there's these philosophical disagreements between the leads.
And, I mean, when you start it literally with the Star Trek II scene, I don't know how you can't make that comparison, right?
Right, right.
Because that's essentially what they do. They go into the nebula right at the beginning.
They do. They do. They tow for the nebula. Yep. But there's so many reasons, I guess, I love this film. This film is the reason I started reading the books, because I was a huge Russell Crowe fan. I really like Gladiator. I really liked A Beautiful Mind. I can't remember all of the... like L.A. Confidential, all the stuff he'd been in up to this point. And it's interesting because I think a lot of what makes this work is the chemistry between, you know, Jack Aubrey, Russell Crowe and Paul Bettany, who played Jack Aubrey and Stephen Matron, respectively. And they had worked on The Beautiful Mind. If you recall, Paul Bettany was his imaginary roommate.
Right.
And they had this like really kind of easygoing chemistry and friendship that was instrumental, because I think that's the, if you don't nail that right, it's like if you cast a Kirk and Spock and they just don't have any chemistry, you're fucked. You're fucked before the thing even starts. And I thought that's really awesome. I also appreciate the historical accuracy. It's like there's very rare historical films where you can't go on YouTube and find like just people savaging, and some of it's fair, some of it's not fair, but you will time and time again hear this as like one of the most historically accurate films of all time, because they filmed aboard a replica of a, you know, 6th-rate frigate, just like the Surprise was. They actually partially rebuilt the ship from plans still on file at the Royal fucking Naval Shipyards for the HMS Surprise.
Huh.
They spent $150 million to do all that.
Wow.
And it's just like, and some of the historical advisors, like there was a guy who had just excavated this sunken like 1792 frigate and had gone and cataloged all of his artifacts. They hired him to be like, you know, supervise the prop department and just like everything, just like they sweat the details. They inspected actual uniforms from captains, lieutenants. They were like ushered into this hermetic room in the Royal Archive of fucking ship clothes or whatever, and were able to feel it and look at it and weigh it and get the fabrics just right. I mean, just everything is completely perfect, from the sailing technology. And you know, that's the other thing. Like I got into this because I was a big Russell Crowe fan, and I've got the first book, cause it was called Master and Commander Far Side of the World. So I got the Master and Commander book that was like at all the stores, and I thought it was excellent, but then I found out that the Far Side of the World was book 10. I'm like, well, that's kind of bullshit. I'm going to skip around. So I just started the whole thing, and, it really made a big impression on me. Like, that's where I got like my desire to start sailing. And now I have a little 16-foot boat, and, it's, I don't know. Like I said, I'm at a loss of like where to begin and where to get in here with you.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about Russell Crowe, because we've seen a couple of his other movies this year. American Gangster is a big one that we watched this year for the first time, I think, both of us. Somehow, if you would ask me at the beginning of this year, is Russell Crowe one of your favorite actors, I'd be like, he's good, but I don't know that he's great.
Steady, reliable, yeah.
After watching a few more of his movies this year, I'm blown away by this guy. He's quietly become one of my favorite actors. We saw, you know, 310 to Yuma not too long ago. I've just been catching up on his catalog. I've always loved A Beautiful Mind and Gladiator and stuff like that. But yeah, he's really become one of my favorite actors.
There's a lot of range there too. Like, you play this mentally ill professor, you play this like kind of nerdy cigarette informer guy. You play this like, you know, conventionally masculine roles in Gladiator and Master and Commander. And he's just really versatile. You know, he can't sing.
He can't sing in Les Mis? I haven't seen it.
He's kind of embarrassing in Les Mis.
Just because he's next to Hugh Jackman, or because... he just can't
well,
do it.
Well, yeah, if you're not a professional singer and you're with professional singers, you do kind of, you know, guys have been on Broadway and can hold a tune. It's pretty rough.
But they wouldn't let him drink. Take him to a karaoke bar.
There you go.
And he's amazing.
Right. I mean, he might be good because he's got a band. He's in a band. He plays guitar.
Right,
he learned to play violin for this, although I was surprised to read that because I thought his violin playing was kind of unconvincing.
Some parts of it were. I was really like paying attention to that. Being a guitar player myself, I'm like hyper aware of that stuff.
Right.
It looked pretty good, but yeah,
some of the stuff he was supposed to like the tremolo, because they had some really complicated pieces.
Yeah.
Because that's a big part of the books. The thing, Jack and Steven are completely dissimilar, but they're kind of like they bond over this shared passion for music, making it and enjoying it. That's how they met. And that's something that is a foundation of the friendship. So you have to have it in there. And I thought that the amount that was in there was just about perfect.
Yeah. And like you said, the chemistry is real good with Paul Bettany, who is another actor I couldn't have necessarily put my finger on and said, this is him by his name, but I know I've seen him in A Knight's Tale, which I thought was really good.
Right.
Probably some other stuff. Definitely A Beautiful Mind.
He was Vision in the new Avengers Marvel Comics universe.
Yeah, I don't think I've seen that one.
I know you have, because I want to say he was. I know he was in Captain America: Civil War.
Was he?
Yeah. But he's also not. He's also not like a. He's got exactly household recognition outside of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
He also was in a weird tenant. I mean, he hasn't. Like, that's the thing is, like, I thought that, like, Paul Bettany would, like, explode. Like, I thought he would get a lot of leading. And it seemed like they gave him a shot, and it just. And it's weird because even this film is amazing, and it got nominated for every major prestigious category for Academy Award in 2003. The problem. It came out during Lord of the Rings: Return of the King,
where
Hollywood collectively decided it's time for us to get on our knees and blow the New Zealander for the billions of dollars he's made for us.
They could have blown Russell Crowe. He's born in New Zealand.
Right? Was he? I thought he's Australian.
No,
he was a Kiwi?
Apparently born
no
in New Zealand. Yeah.
Interesting. And it's like, you know, what's you got all this sucking up all the oxygen. It is interesting because if you like browse like some of the movie subreddits, you'll see that this is often mentioned as some of the most underrated films, or films that haven't got their due, or films that have come cult classic isn't the right word for it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I am always surprised that, number one, it didn't make a bunch of money because, although the other thing is like, why do you think it didn't make a lot of money?
Because they spent a lot of money.
Well, yeah.
I think they could have done this thing for $80 million doubled their budget.
But $212 million worldwide is what it made. That seems low for something with this much star power. And, like, are period pieces bad? Is it the fact that the title's 30 words long?
Yeah.
Master and Commander, the Far Side of the World. Like, what the fuck?
Yeah. I really don't know. Because I think, like... Obviously, I'm the exception to the rule here, and I think maybe Pirates is successful because it's more way more fun.
Yeah.
But I would much rather watch Master and Commander movies getting 5-10 sequels than fucking Pirates of the Caribbean.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, it's strange to me that this didn't become more of a hit. Now, maybe they should have gone and done a sequel pretty close to this one, because then you'd have some brand recognition there.
Right.
With the Master and Commander series, but I guess it was maybe too risky how the first one didn't do super well.
Yeah.
But it did. I mean, how can you complain when you make $70 million?
I right. And I guess with marketing, and I remember it being particularly poorly marketed. Like, you know, there wasn't the big budget. Like, for $150 million, there wasn't even like a half. And sometimes you see this. Like, I saw that with that Cloud Atlas. Like, you know, fuck it. We're just going to like throw it out there and do a couple commercials the week before, and there you go. I felt like it's almost like the studio gave up on it before it was, you know, for whatever reason. I just remember being poorly marketed and being kind of outraged it didn't get the attention it did. Because the other thing is, the other thing I guess that limits its appeal is like, this movie doesn't pass the Bechdel test. Like, in fact, it might only have 3 seconds of women in the whole film.
Yeah.
And I don't know to what extent that limits its appeal.
Probably a bit.
Yeah.
Probably.
But
a
I also
bit.
Don't think it's a traditional, just like testosterone fueled, fucking stupid action film war movie. There's
no,
like a
totally.
lot of depth and a lot of. The other thing it does really well is it throws you in the middle of these situations, just like the books do. Like, you don't have a long introduction to Jack and Steven when they meet. It's just they meet at this music hall. They almost get in a duel. And then the stuff just happens. And Patrick O'Brien doesn't give a shit about how much you know about sailing. He's going to be talking, you know, he's going to be throwing you top gallants and foresails and bosuns and all this right off the bat. And what I thought was great in the movie, like the first 15 minutes, like Jack is giving this detailed account of the battle to the doctor, and he gives like all this jargon, and the doctor's like, I don't know. I can't pretend to know precisely what it is you're talking about. Uh-huh. And that's kind of his role through the first books, is he's the landlubber who's always being like, what the fuck are you guys talking about? This makes no sense to me. And also kind of a sign that, like, you can largely treat the sailing terminology as technobabble.
Sure, yeah.
And just trust that you're not going to get left behind if you don't understand every fucking word. And just kind of, like, let it wash over you. And by the third book, it's similar to like watching The Wire. Like you start at first you're like, oh my god, I can never remember all these characters, and by like the fifth or sixth episode you'll just get it.
Yeah,
and you kind of have to trust the creators to do that. But I thought they did that well.
I do have like a lot of questions about, you know, terminology and about how this stuff works and why they're doing certain things they're doing.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you can answer them, but
I probably can. So, I hope so.
So I guess I didn't realize going into this how much of like common colloquialisms come from the Navy.
Yeah,
like there were a couple things. So okay, this is not a colloquialism, but what the fuck does beat to quarters mean? Because when I hear the word quarters, I think everybody go to sleep. Like, beat to your quarters, get the fuck out of here and go to sleep.
It means,
but it's exactly the opposite.
Yeah, it's essentially like red alert for Star Trek. It's the drummer literally beats a drum that lets every man in ship know that they all have assigned battle stations. Essentially,
are those quarters?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, and they also, the other thing they did, which I thought was, and the first time I saw this movie, I'd already read several of the books, but they talk about like anytime there's a gunnery exercise or battle, they make a clean sweep fore and aft. And what that literally means is all the fucking walls in a ship just are disassembled in a matter of seconds.
Oh, like, yeah. I saw
and they
them
showed that
one
really
back
cool.
Together.
Like, as Russell Crowe is walking through the ship after a battle or a gun exercise, you can see, like, the way, like, Captain Picard, the door's like, hiss. There's literally carpenters assembling the walls around them as he's walking into his quarters, and people are setting his dining room table back in place. Like when the ship's geared for war, there ain't shit in the way. Everything's either down in the hull, or like they throw all the boats overside because they don't want them on the deck, and they might have to tow the ship in a battle. And
so that's the thing I was wondering about, those I thought they were lifeboats that were going out. Like, if the ship sinks, we can get to these boats. And
I mean, that's one of their purposes.
Yeah, then they use them to tow the boat into the nebula.
Exactly. Because like, you know, when the ship takes battle damage, it can't maneuver. If you get your rudder shot away like the Surprise did, you literally can't maneuver. So you have like you can do things like have your men tow right into the eye of the wind, so the enemy has a hard time following. And then if you make it to a fog bank, if you make it to nebula, then
right.
But yeah,
the other term you mentioned this, so they were disabled and they say we're like fish in a barrel. Is fish in a barrel like supposed to talk about sailors in a boat that's disabled?
I don't think so.
Is that the original
I think it
usage?
Literally is like there's fish in a barrel and you're shooting them.
Okay. All right, then that term doesn't come from the Navy, I imagine.
But there is like a lot of like they mentioned, like, I'd rather have my men being three sheets to the wind on occasion than be, you know, that's a nautical term. Like, a sheet to the wind means your men have like let one of like, because you know, the ship's attached to the top of these, I think they're called cross trees, and then they're secured at the bottom. And if you have a sloppy crew or someone that doesn't know their job, they might let one of those lines fly, and then the thing will just. So if you had three sheets to, like,
then you're not moving.
Then it's like the whole fucking ship is just like it's a really, you know,
it's chaos.
Yeah, it's chaos. So it's like a drunken, slovenly pirate type of ship.
Okay. And the final one that I have a question about, somewhere along the line in this movie, I saw a guy sitting on the front of the ship taking a shit, which it was the middle of winter and he's freezing to death on the front of this boat. I don't know why he's doing that, but. You said this is literally, I think you said this is where the term the head comes
from.
It
is, yeah.
Ah, Jesus.
People go to the head.
Why go to the front of the boat to do that? A, I see a couple of problems. A, it's very windy up there, right? So you're going to freeze your nuts off, literally. Right. B, you're shitting all over the boat because the wind is just blowing the shit right onto the boat.
So
why not go to the back of the boat to do this?
Okay. Well, there's some practical answers and some political answers.
Oh boy.
So what divides the officers from the crew is the main mast. Like you say, like you've got your officers and then the foremast jacks, mm-hmm. and that literally means the sailors that are before the mast.
Okay.
And behind, you know, backwards from the mast, like everyone, like even the midshipmen, which are the junior officers, they have a combined quarters, but they have privacy. You know, they have bunks and stuff, but they're not sleeping ass to ass in hammocks with the men.
Uh-huh.
Then the like lieutenants and the warrant officers have small cabins, and then the captain has the biggest one. Captain's the only one that has a shitter. And they actually show that when he's like examining a hole blown through, you can kind of see that's
his hole, yeah,
his quarter galley. Uh-huh. But the men, the reason they have to shit up front is because the ships are designed with this thing called tumble home, which means they're wider at the waterline than they are at the actually rail.
Huh, okay.
And there's a bunch of reasons. It shifts the center of gravity around, but also makes it harder to board. Because if you come up against each other, you're still like 16 feet apart. Yep. So if you just hang your ass over the side, you're going to literally shit on the side of the ship.
Right.
So the custom is to go to the front where there's like, you know, it's just going to drop right into the ocean, and they do the windward side, so the smell would be blown
away from
the thing. But you're not allowed. You wouldn't be allowed to shit in the captain's galley.
Just because the captain kind of owns the back of the boat.
He does.
Which is another thing I've never understood.
Uh-huh. What is that?
Go ahead.
I was going to say, the other thing is like they a lot of times Patrick O'Brien refers to the quarter deck as the holy quarter deck. Mm-hmm. And the windward side especially is like that's for the captain. Like you don't fucking go and bother the captain unless he asks you to or unless you have something very damn important to report you know, there's a lot of ice. That's the other thing. There's a lot of loneliness and isolation to that command that we can talk about, because I want to talk about the leadership and command aspects too. But your other question?
So if I were to tell you, look, I've got a new car that I'm making, and the steering wheel is in front of a seat that is mounted to the back of the car. It's the trunk. And between you and the front of the car and the road that you're looking down is going to be a giant flapping piece of canvas. That you won't be able to see around in the best of circumstances.
Right.
Would you buy that car?
You know, if it's the only game in town.
So this is my problem with the boats.
And
maybe it's a safety thing. Maybe the captain's at the back of the boat so he doesn't get shot by cannonballs. Mm-hmm. But why isn't the captain at the front of the boat?
Because you're right. The steering mechanism is in the back of the boat because the rudder is in the back of the boat. And, like, a linkage that would run to the very front of the
boat. Guess it'd get destroyed pretty
easily.
Exactly. Yeah.
Like, it's those things are, like, that's the most the ass of the boat's the most vulnerable. If you had some kind of chain or rope system going through the entire ship, well, then any ball that goes through it could sever that all-important link.
Well, if you put 2 feet of oak around it.
Well, that's what the Americans did.
Yeah.
So the other thing is the quarterdeck is like elevated.
Mm-hmm.
And in battle or when they're doing maneuvers, they'd like the lower main sails would all be kind of up. So you have a lot more you'd have a lot more visibility.
It's only when you're trying to outrun.
Yeah.
Like run really fast.
You're just running.
Sail down the full way or something.
Yeah. And it's a lot less important to see where you're going when you're there's so much fucking space in the ocean.
Yeah, right.
And they know from their charts, like, you know, they've got 500 miles of sea room before they even have to start worrying about running aground. So it's more important to just fucking take your fastest point of sail and either run or chase this guy.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah. But the other thing is like, I'm kind of jumping all over the place, but the historical accuracy, the one nick is that they did a lot of like unfixable damage by moving in the books. The Far Side of the World takes place in 1813,
right,
when England's at war with America.
Mm-hmm.
And this Acheron, this French 44-gun warship, is actually supposed to be, the USS Norfolk,
yep,
which was a series of these super heavy 44-gun frigates that, like, the USS Constitution, the first of its class, was nicknamed Old Ironsides because the British ships literally couldn't penetrate. It was so massively overbuilt that cannon shot would bounce off its sides.
Yeah.
And they showed that in the movie. But they were worried with this historical piece, like, if you literally are selling, like, the fact that, like, England's at war with America, and what Americans think about that. Here's the thing. Like, I'm trying to figure the person that's unsophisticated enough to be offended at the idea that we were ones at war with Britain.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think they make the French the bad guys. like, I felt like there was a lot of, like, this isn't like a Wrath of Khan situation where the two captains hate each other. There's a lot of mutual respect.
They're certainly the antagonist, but yeah.
I mean, they're killing definitely. Each other because they have to, but there's not...
There's respect.
Yeah, right. there's a respect there. And I don't know why they did that, but they shifted it back to 1805, but took the plot from the movie, which does a whole bunch of things to the chronology that doesn't make sense. Like, you know, Jack's talking about... like when he was a teenager serving with Lord Nelson, but he's talking about something that was like just a couple of years ago, not like 15 years ago.
Huh. Okay.
And also, like, you know, like the idea that the whole war hinges on this frigate sinking whalers.
Yeah.
Like that doesn't make, I mean,
protect the Brazilian coast, I guess.
Right. And I mean, I get it. Like it's a lot of money. Like, you know, that one ship was 12,000 pounds or whatever. So like there is economic damage done there, but I think that was only a couple months before the decisive battle of Trafalgar, where Lord Nelson died. So, like, literally, that little small skirmish is it's kind of like saving Private Ryan in the scope of World War II.
Sure, yeah.
Like, it means a lot to these people, but but the way they made it seem like it was just life and death, I thought was a little much.
Yeah, I think the other like realities of being on a boat like that. That I thought was interesting, especially when in that first scene where they're in heavy fog, and they've got their eye out. And I got the impression that they weren't just looking for other boats. They were also looking for obstacles and treacherous terrain, essentially. Because when you think about it, like you're on a boat, you're moving pretty fast. You can't turn this thing on a dime. You can't stop it on a dime. You can't stop it at all.
Right.
Well, you can, but. It's hard. That's got to be a scary thing too. Is just moving this giant thing around, even though the sea is huge. There's a lot of stuff out there that you might not know about.
And when they're off the coast, especially like it's a great job showing like all the technology they brought to bear. Like when they say they ask for a lead, like literally it means they take a lead weight. They throw it down the side of the ship, and then when it goes slack, that's how deep they are. But they also there's so unbelievably clever things like that. They would the bottom of that thing was concave, and they would smear lard on it, and that would also they would tell you the depth, and they'd say it's like sand and broken shell, and that would give you a clue to like how close you are because they didn't have GPS. They were essentially relying on their ship's chronometers, which are these like precise timekeeping. To keep track of like how far they're going east to west. I hope I got this right. And then they're calculating when the sun makes noon overhead to decide, you know, how north-south they are. But it's all like approximate. And if it's like they've been a couple days of like cloudy weather, it's called dead reckoning, where it's essentially the captain's best guess of where he thinks they are. Yeah. So, yeah,
And they do a lot of cool stuff with that, I think. You know, whenever they use the term, like, seamanship in this movie, right? That's kind of what they're talking about, is being able to use those tools to navigate the boat exactly where they want to be. And that's why, I guess, it's so impressive when he comes up right behind the Acheron.
And there's a lot of stuff in the books where O'Brien will talk about how Jack's literally standing on deck, feeling the boat shift under him, feeling the forestays and how tight they are,
and the wind,
and doing all these trigonometry because he's trained in like all these like math and geometry, and doing all these calculations and intercept solutions in his head because that's what like you know, it seemed like the more successful captain sweated the small stuff, and they showed that like there's a scene where the men are preparing for battle and. They're actually like chipping the rust off of the cannonballs because they want to make them super smooth so they don't deviate in their flight path.
Yeah.
And like some captains wouldn't bother. And like the other thing is like they showed Jack whipping his men into like where they can do a broadside a minute apart. Like, you know, and that was super expensive. Something they go in the books like Jack spends a lot of his personal money buying gunpowder. Because the Navy, like a lot of captains, they call it dumb exercise where the men just simulate shooting, but they don't, you know, that you can't get good at actually hitting a target. And it's not as good as actually firing the real thing and hitting a target. And that's why one of the reasons Jack's ships are always so good is because he spends the time to make them into like a crack crew.
Also, I imagine in a mock, you know, situation, you couldn't really, how do you get that recoil, right?
Right.
They make
the
point
of,
about. Yeah. Like the recoil of the cannons being the thing that allows you to reload them.
Right.
And how they'd only get one shot because they pull the wheels off. And,
right.
I imagine in a dummy fire situation, you couldn't really do that.
Right. And it's like, you know, men would get initially get hurt in these exercises because you're not ready for this 1,000-pound thing to jump back at you.
Yeah.
You know, with all the Newton's laws in effect. And there's also, like, when, like, if you fire them when after, like, several hours or a long time of sustained cannon fire, the cannons get so hot that the metal would start to droop. And then they would actually start jumping then they would, like, you know, because now they're pointed down slightly force, down.
Yeah.
And then they would get, like, sometimes they would fucking explode. That's the thing is, like, ship-to-ship combat was so fucking lethal and bloody.
Like, they do a pretty good job of depicting it in the first battle with the Acheron. It's there's nowhere to hide.
No.
Like, that's the thing. On this little ship where the cannonballs actually make it through the hole,
right,
there's nowhere to hide.
Right.
You just get as flat as you can, maybe lay, like, head to toe toward their ship if possible, and just hope it doesn't hit you.
It's just dumb luck that these bowling balls are coming, you know, waist high across your deck at 600 miles an hour.
Right.
And when they hit wood, they just turn into
The thing.
Like, just massive missiles and shit crashing down on the deck. And
it's not even just that. It looked like a lot of people were just getting destroyed by the shrapnel of the boat itself. The cannonball hits. It just turns the hull into its own bit of shrapnel, and people were getting it in the neck and the legs and the arms. It looked like what's his face, the young kid who loses his arm,
Blakely
might have lost his arm from shrapnel.
Yeah The splinters he got in there.
Yeah,
and that's the thing, like, almost any potential wound was could be fatal.
But the
sound design of this is, like, widely revered. Like, if you got a nice 7.1 setup, get the Master and Commander Blu-ray and enjoy, because they actually got period accurate cannons and took actual recordings of them firing from, like, point blank range and from different yardage to simulate the set. They fired chain shot, they fired grape shot, and they got all those different sounds that they'd mix in there, and it's, like, just real. And they also blasted wooden targets. And then the other thing the sound design guy thought was really interesting is he made this rig out of wood that he bolted into the back of a pickup truck, and then he ran 1,000 feet of cordage through it, and then he would drive down the highway at various speeds, like from 30 to 70 miles an hour, to get the like, you know, a moderate breeze up to a typhoon shriek of, like, what it would sound like for the wind to be whipping through the cordage.
Yeah.
And it sounds amazing.
Like, yeah.
Between the realism of the ocean and the sounds and the costuming, and it just utterly, even though it's a weird in the historicity of its setup, like, the actual encounters are extremely accurate.
Yeah, so it did win an Oscar, I guess. It went up against Lord of the Rings, won a couple of Oscars, one for sound engineering.
And cinematography is the other one, I thought.
Yeah. So definitely I think it deserved it. Like, Lord of the Rings is great, don't get me wrong, but holy crap.
Yeah. I sometimes wonder if this had been, like, if it won for Best Picture, Best Director, like, what kind of different legacy might it have had?
And I actually think I like the visuals on this better than, like, Lord of the Rings, because Lord of the Rings was around the time when you could still see the CG on the screen. And this movie, I think, does such a good job at hiding it. You know, even though it's there, you can barely tell, if at all.
And most of the stuff is practical. Like, again, all of the water effects are actual. They don't ever simulate the ocean. They take real footage and then they composite their models and they composite their mock-ups. And then they also just, most of the time where you just see them tooling around the ocean and it's, like, relatively calm and not bad, that's a real fucking ship.
Yeah.
That's sailing with an experienced crew that knows, and that just, you can't fake it.
Yeah.
I
guess Weta also made, like, a scale model of the ship.
Yeah. Oh, there's tons of fucking models of this thing.
But they had a one-to-one. They had a full-size model
In
a Titanic tank, whatever you said.
And you can see it was the HMS Rose. Peter Weir bought it for this production. And it's since been renamed HMS Surprise, and it's I guess it sails a couple times a year for, like, they'll take you on board for big money.
Yeah.
It's in a naval museum. I'm not sure which one in San Diego. So that's one of my bucket list things is I'd like to go. I want to go see the Constitution in Boston. I'd like to go see the Rose or the Surprise in San Diego, and I would love to go see shit, I can't remember the Victory, the HMS Victory that's over in London. That's yeah. Nelson's flagship. 100 some gun, fucking crazy ass big boat.
Yeah, we don't really have stuff like this anymore, right? Especially since this experience is, yeah. Aside from like crab fishing, like right. The deadliest catch is about the closest thing I can think of to this.
Right.
But you know, all modern warfare is done from afar.
Right. And there's nothing like on an aircraft carrier, a modern destroyer. There's no storm that can really threaten a ship like that.
Yeah, they're so huge.
Right. They're made out of steel.
Yeah. They're going to float no matter what.
Fuck your 2 foot of oak. I got 2 foot of steel.
Right.
And I mean, there's certainly, you know, Jack couldn't be obliterated from 500 nautical miles away without even seeing the enemy.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's not exactly safe, but it's different. Like the sea has largely been for military and big commercial vessels tamed.
Yeah.
But the other thing is, like, there's other stuff that surprises you, like the fact that, like, the men sleep in such close, cramped, uncomfortable quarters. The mm-hmm. fact that there's livestock aboard.
Yeah, yeah, for food, yeah. is my guess. Yeah, not to eat the animals, but eat their products.
Well, I mean, they do both. Like, they kind of ration it. Like, well, okay, at what point does the milk, having fresh milk and eggs, outweigh the fact that we haven't had protein, like anything but shitty salt beef?
Yeah.
So, you know, the captain's going to have a big fancy dinner and they're going to butcher one of the lambs or one of the goats. But it's a really cool detail. And you don't think that, like, there's a fucking manger. Uh-huh. There's like all this firewood because they have to cook 3 meals a day for these dudes. There's unfathomable quantities of rum.
Yeah.
Because these guys drink like a fucking pint of rum a day mixed in with water and lime juice to keep them from getting scurvy.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the medical tech was really on display. Now, the thing about the surprise is Steven is an actual doctor. Like, mm-hmm. he's a university-educated doctor of his time. Most surgeons are more like butchers, but it shows him doing an amputation. He trepans a guy that had a depressed skull fracture. But it's all – and I don't know. Like, the first time I saw that – little kid getting his arm amputated, I about fucking passed out in the theater.
You were Russell Crowe, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then the other thing is like, there's some things that you want to call unrealistic about this movie, but like almost it all has actually happened somewhere, sometime. Like there's been doctors that have operated on themselves. It's unlikely mm-hmm. that all these badasses would be collected in this one moment of time.
Yeah.
But, you know, it does happen. So anyway, yeah.
I kind of want to talk about the main characters and then maybe
before we move on from the historical bric-a-brac. Mm-hmm. I know that you and I have both expressed disbelief at like young people in positions of command authority.
Yeah, yeah.
How did you think? Because this is from everything I can tell, this is actually typical of the mm-hmm. ages of some of these midshipmen and the roles they'd be given in ship combat. Did you find it unrealistic or?
I guess not, and I don't know why I don't have the problem here. Maybe it's because it's just so convincing the way it's done. But, yeah, I mean, Blakely seems to be pretty competent,
mm-hmm.
And he's very young. He must be, what, 10?
I was thinking 11? 12. Yeah. And, like, Calamy, the next one older, is, like, the 15 or 16.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know. I did not have a problem with it here.
Because it seems
But he seemed to be very much under the tutelage of Russell right. Crowe, of like Jack Aubrey.
Yeah, like when he assumes command, it's late in the film and it's kind of like desperate circumstances. But yeah,
it's like we'll all be off the boat. If this right. fails, we lose the boat anyway, so go for it, kid.
And also a lot of these, because promotion was so dependent on like seniority, like a lot of, if like you were a son of a captain or a nobleman, a lot of times they would get you on the ship like 6 or 7. As a midshipman, and then you've been learning the trade since by the time you're 12 or 13, you're ready to like start supervising watches. And they kind of showed like that whole, like there's like 6 and 7 year old boys running powder from the magazines to the cannon.
Uh-huh.
And then there's like the midshipmen that are like super in, like some of them are cowering on deck because they're shitting their pants as the first battle. And then some are like, you know, just on the cusp of lieutenant, and you have the different lieutenants that, you know, the senior one that's going to become a captain at the end. And I felt like that they did a good job of showing that. And you're right, like it's different from Lady Mormont, who is just all by herself. You didn't see her kind of like grow up, or you don't see any of the protos. She's just leading the house and she's speaking like this queen. And for some reason that I don't think it's the kids' performance. I think it's more like the world just suddenly threw that at you.
Yeah, I mean, it's also partially, I think the kid doesn't have as much adult kind of, you know, dialogue and mm-hmm. stuff like that to do. Really, he has a moment where he is a friend to Paul Bettany, Matron.
Yeah.
When he's disappointed about not getting to go to the island,
right.
Giving the beetle. He has that pretty adult moment, I thought. And then he has an adult moment where he makes a choice when everyone's off the boat that they need help. Let's go do it.
Right.
Because they're going to blow us to smithereens.
And he also
so he doesn't have like a lot of adult type stuff to do.
Right.
It's very sparsely thrown in, which I thought was made it more believable than if he were up there commanding the fucking ship for half the movie.
And also they show how like the twin influences of Jack and Steven have matured him, and it's like you know, him defending Hollum, the men saw as this cursed Jonah figure.
Mm-hmm.
There's all this undercurrent of like what a commander does to inspire respect and get the respect and admiration of his men, and you can see like him following like all those things in little ways. So mm-hmm. when he actually does assume command at the end, it's not like this like what the fuck, or it's not a cloud. It just makes sense.
Yeah.
Anyway, what were you going to say?
A couple of other things I want to talk about, and they're broad. The narrative of the film, like the plot and why it's effective and, you know, what it does right and wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And also the main characters, because that's kind of a lot of what this plot hinges on.
Right.
Where do you want to start? Do you want to go broadly with the plot or
focus
in? Okay. So I actually thought it was interesting not showing the POV of the other ship at all.
Mm.
Because there you could certainly make a case, I guess, for showing it, but I think it served to make it more mysterious. There's this question, like, at the beginning of the movie, how did they find us?
Mm-hmm.
It's damn near impossible in this ocean to find anything.
Right.
How'd they find us? Is there a spy in the ranks?
Right.
And even then, how did they find us? Like,
right.
We're a dot on this radar.
Blip.
Even after the movie's over, I don't think I have an answer to that question. But because it's so mysterious and it's kept that way through the whole movie, I don't think I needed one.
But you also, they have such a mirrored relationship, this captain and Jack, because they turn the tables on each other several times, of course. So when you see Jack up all night with his charts plotting and looking at his time to the minute for when he's making the turns, you can kind of imagine that the other guy doing that with Jack, that they're roughly equivalent comp, but the other guy's got the better ship.
And they show them like actually looking at each other across the deck,
which I thought is so
a couple
cool.
of times. Yeah,
like the cap, you can see Jack look at him with the telescope as he's looking at Jack with the telescope.
Yeah,
and
there's
like,
the glint from the.
It's not Khan showing up on the main monitor and saying, "From hell's hot heart, I spit at thee," but it gives you a little bit of that.
Yeah, you. So that's the interesting thing. Like, you understand through Jack what the other captain is thinking, like you said,
right?
And there's never any direct communication between
right.
them, which I love because you almost don't need it. I mean, you see the lengths that Jack goes to disguise this ship
right
at the end. And you're thinking, is that really necessary? Like, how far do you need to go for this ruse? But then you think about what Jack is observing
mm-hmm.
about the other ship, right? The number of guns,
right.
the thickness of the hull. He's got the fucking model of it that's
right.
going to help him understand how to defeat it, what he's working against. And you think, okay, yeah, you shouldn't just close up the portholes and hide the cannons.
Right.
Maybe you should repaint the ship. Maybe you should, like, get everybody in the right garb.
Mm-hmm.
There's just a lot of stuff that goes into it that shows you that the other captain is smart.
Right.
And the other captain knows to look for these things.
Yeah, and the fact that, like, they're really sweating the details. Like, hey, don't use military precision when you're adjusting lines. Make it look like you're a little panicked and worried and that it's the little things. And I feel like that's
mm-hmm.
the books do a especially good job of showing that it's the captains that sweat the little details. It's those 1-2% advantages in combat that win the day. When you're talking about a ship with 28 guns, you know, like the ship that has a crack team that can fire all of those at peak efficiency is going to beat the one that is, you know, can only shoot half broadside for every one of the others, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you can make up superior numbers and... And the other thing is, like, it doesn't make the other captain look stupid because you could see Jack falling for the same thing because he's got similar appetites. He wants to make money. He wants to make a name for himself. He wants to help his country. So it's like it's the rare ruse that plays like, you know, it feels smart when the main characters execute it. The other people don't look dumb.
Right. It's like a very high level chess match, right?
Yeah.
As opposed to watching Kasparov destroy a 10-year-old who's never played.
It's funny because some of the unreal, some things I roll my eyes at, because like the idea that Jack would only get this idea after Steven shows him a twig bug is kind of dumb, because like, you know, these ruse de guerre or whatever, flying false colors and disguising your ship is pretty routine, and it's played on both sides. Like, there's a lot of Indian merchantmen that had no cannons that would paint gun ports on their side to make a guy, like, if you're, you know, and it's the other thing, it's like, it's not like utterly convincing, like it's not going to hold up to close scrutiny, but if a guy's deciding whether he's going to attack you and he's like, well, I got my hold half full and I'm also running out of cordage and mass because I went through that storm, fuck it, it ain't worth it, I'm gonna pass you, it's one of those things. You're not playing like absolute, it's all percentages.
Which that percentage might also get you killed, right? If you're a whaling ship and you disguise yourself as a gunship,
right,
they might just open fire.
Right. And not try to take you a prize.
Yeah.
So the other thing I thought they did really well is they hint to a lot of things that are important in the book. Like, Jack and Steven in the books are kind of equals, because Jack is like the master of the sea, but Steven's like the master of medicine and science. But he's also one of Britain's most important spies.
Oh,
and he's got this, like, and you don't find this out, like, they hint in the first book or two, but it's made explicit by, like, the third book, that he's, like, this really high-level spy that is using his real vocation as a physician and a natural, what do you call that?
I think it's naturalist, yeah.
A naturalist of some regard as cover, so he can go, like, because he can still, during war, go to Paris and, as a scientist, address their academy and, you know, make contacts and stuff.
Yeah.
So they have that hint where they're talking about spies. It's like, well, England has spies as well as France. The book reader's like, whoo, they're hitting towards Stephen's secret career. And a lot of stuff, like, there's other, like, a lot of, like, the really deep characterizations of Jack, like the fact that he's not very funny, but he really values wit. Like, because they have these jokes where, you know, the weevil joke. It's really dumb and pun, but, like, Jack and all the other drunken officers love it, and Steven's like, Jesus Christ, these guys.
Yeah.
And also there's a couple of times where Jack's famous for, like, me getting things almost right but kind of wrong. Like, he's like, well, don't count the eggs before we put them in the pudding. That was, like, a throwaway line that, like, makes a book reader really happy.
Huh.
Because it's... I saw some negative reviews from Patrick O'Brien fans are like, well, they just don't get the relationship between Jack and Steven right. Well, how the fuck could they? They're trying to fit 20 books worth of shit.
Yeah.
And there's like, there's some, I mean, I'm going to make a pitch for people to read the books here at the end of the review. But like, there's some things that take 5 or 6 books to pay off. That, like, how in the hell can you possibly expect to get that in a 2.5-hour movie? I walked away being very impressed that they're able to get the essence of what makes the men, like, best friends, but also the things that divide them. You know, Steven's much more of a libertine. He doesn't like the idea of, you know, man dominating man, but Jack's a ship captain that has to flog people every once in a while.
Yeah, no, I think it's... It shows, you know, that it sort of takes both kinds of people to get anything done, right?
Right.
Like, a guy like Matron wouldn't be able to protect himself from the French captain.
Right.
He'd probably be sunk that first day.
Right.
He doesn't have the ingenuity and the cunning and the that kind of stuff that Jack has. But, you know, Jack also doesn't have, I guess, the naturalist view of things, right?
Right.
It takes the naturalist to give him the stick bug idea to actually win the day. So, you know, they need to come together. You need both types of people in order to make it work.
And there's a couple of, like, there's a point in the books where Stephen and Jack are taken prisoner at the beginning of the War of 1812. And they're held in Boston, and Steven's the one that, like, springs him out and gets him safe passages out of the country because he's a spy and he knows how to work those. And Jack's, like, kind of more or less helpless.
He would have tried to punch his way out. Yeah.
Right. Like, you got, you know, Steven's a deadly fellow himself. And there's, like, some just, yeah, I'll get to this later. But I thought that they did more than what I was, because I was not, by the time I had gotten to see the movie, I was like four or five books in. I'm like, I don't see how in the hell. Mm-hmm. Like, I was expecting just kind of like a greatest hits action adventure, and I was actually impressed by how much they nailed the relationship, not just between Jack and Steven, but like Jack and his officers, and the unique mm-hmm. quality that Jack has where he can be friendly with the men, but not friends. Yeah, that Picard thing.
Right.
Where, like, the men love him clearly, but he doesn't ever, like,
he doesn't play poker with him.
That's the distance he's keeping. I'll let Riker do that.
Yeah.
Riker's the guy that they can think of as a buddy and cry on his shoulder. Uh-huh. I'm the one that, like, you don't take that shit to me. So I thought they nailed that, and the relationship between, like, how fucking superstitious sailors were at the time.
Yeah.
Like, that Jonah shit's a real thing to them.
And even the captain, which hashtag not my hero, because, like, I'm not on board with that captain. There's no curses, but
I don't think he really believes it, but one of the things about Jack's past is that he got in trouble as a midshipman. He was 13 years old and he snuck a girl on board.
Mm-hmm.
And the captain flogged him and then disrated him, which made him a fort. So he got to spend time with the common men.
Mm-hmm.
And he learned that the way they think about things. And like, I think that statement, Steven's like, oh my God, you believe this shit too. And it's more like, I don't necessarily believe it. I might believe a little bit because I'm a sailor and some of this shit's just in our bones, but also like the men believe it.
Right.
And you're not going to convince these men who can't read and write.
Yeah.
And there's a shit ton more of them than us that they're, you know, you can't
like
just
the ship believes it.
Yeah.
It's not about him at that moment.
And there's a couple deleted scenes that I watched this morning. They do a great job of showing why that is. Like, the men are in the South Pacific for the first time and there's humpback whales singing.
Huh.
But echoing through this wooden ship, the men just like, Jesus Christ, what fucking sea ghoul lives in the Pacific that would cause this? And like, Jack gives them permission to sleep with the lights on. Because they're just, like, kind of scared little kids. But it makes sense because they don't know what the fuck a whale would sound like. And, like, they don't know why sometimes you can go, like, 20 days, 30 days without wind, but it's a deadly situation.
Mm-hmm.
That's another great thing they did. Like, when they showed the surprise in the middle of all this water, it's flat, there's glass, and there's no wind at all, and there's no rain, and they have a finite supply of food and water, and that shit gets scary. And sometimes a lot of mutinies were just like the captain, like, look, I'm doing the best I can, and men are like, well, you're a fucking Jonah or whatever, and then that's what happens.
Wow. I like the friendship between the two characters, even though, like you said, they are very different. They do have some similarities, and I think the movie does a good job of showing in that sort of like muted, very masculine, very like military style way that it has of showing the relationship and the friendship and the caring that these two have for each other. Right. Like, they're both. So Jack is clearly going the Ahab route for a little while in this movie. And Steven tries to talk to him and say, look, this is what's happening. Your pride is getting in the way. Jack doesn't actually acknowledge it right there and then during that conversation, but later on he does, right? He understands, okay, maybe you're right about this, and he, you know, it takes Steven getting shot in the gut and potentially being about to die with this terrible doctor trying to perform surgery on a moving ship. So he does eventually take him back to Galapagos, and then Steven makes the same sacrifice for Jack, right? He sees this boat coming in. He's like, now's the chance. If I don't tell him about this, A, it might cause us all to die. B, this is what he wants.
Right. It might cause a friendship.
Yeah, so let me give him that opportunity and sacrifice the thing that I've come here for.
Right.
And then at the end, they seem to have come together on it, right?
Right.
Like, Steven knows, okay, we got to go after this ship. It's the perfect opportunity. Well, not even it's a perfect opportunity, but we need to
do
something about
this
captain.
Yeah.
Who disguised himself as a doctor. And Jack is like, well, we'll get back to Galapagos. Essentially making him an unspoken promise there,
right?
Which I thought was really cool. I liked.
Yeah, I did like, and I was hoping you picked that up because I think that's one of the main narrative things in the movie is the fact that there's this symmetry between the sacrifice. Like, Jack says, I will grind whatever grist is required. And you see him. There's like a couple like spot going into reactor room moments where men die for the good of the ship. But when it comes to Steven, he just can't do it. Like, and they don't spell that out. It's like 2 minutes worth of, you know, Russell Crowe walking around the ship and like starting to chase after Acheron and Steven like waning, and and then you see him walking.
You could have had the Mufasa moment, right? Where,
right.
Like, Steven's words echo in his head, pride's getting in your way or whatever.
Right.
It was about pride, and he could have turned around, but they didn't. They were more classy than that, which I like.
Yeah, but the fact that they're both willing to sacrifice things that are important to them for the other's health or happiness, I thought is... First, I mean, I don't know how the men take it. Like,
yeah,
you know, what's his face gets we hack his wreckage off the gunwale and he dies in this horrific storm. Which I always think when I see that, like, what must that be like?
Oh man,
the poor guy knows how to swim, so he's not going to die instantly. But he's in the middle of this fucking wet hell.
Yeah, and even if he can survive the storm, like grab onto the mast or something, and float there for a while. He's still dead. He's in the middle of nowhere.
You can't swim the shore from there. You're fucked.
No, you're done. Yeah, that's no good. I'd rather grab a cannonball and go under.
Yeah, I saw that's the other interesting thing is unusual for sailors to learn how to swim for that reason, because they thought if they ever got in battle or whatever swept off, I'd rather just fucking drown than have my death agonies prolonged any longer than necessary.
Yeah, okay. I can see it.
But again, they're like I say. That's not I'm like I'm gonna fight for my life to the last breath. But that's the other thing is like people thought differently back then.
Yeah,
like
there's a very like
that also doesn't seem fake that in a lot of ships, men, even though they were pressed from their homes, and all this, they were like eager to get into battle because it was number one fun and number two potentially profitable because these sailors could make a lifetime's worth of pay in an afternoon's work if they're if they're able to capture this vessel and it's like this, they have 12,000 pounds worth of prime sperm whale oil on board, like that could set a man up for life.
Yeah.
So they were like, between patriotism, the belief that heaven awaited them if they were valorous and combat and money, it's so weird. There wasn't a lot of. I don't know. I'm trying to put in a modern war pick, there would be a lot more, I think, like people cowering or, like the Upham character and Saving Private Ryan. There's not much of that. I mean, Hollum's the closest. He's a good sailor, a terrible commander, and he's in a situation where he'd probably be happy as a midshipman forever, but that's just not how the Navy wants you to be.
Yeah, no, that's interesting because there's... right after that scene, there's Russell Crowe delivering a speech about how, he wouldn't have become the man he thought he wanted to be or something.
Right. Not everyone gets to become the man they want to be.
Yeah. And I got a very, retrospectively, I got a very, Klingon vibe from this guy. Like, if I can't be the honorable person I wanted to be and it just doesn't work out exactly how I want it for me, I'm going to just, that's it. I'm done.
Plus,
instead of like living with a little bit of disappointment in your life, like do that, man.
Well, there was like once I thought they also showed that almost like the Stephen King, Stanley Kubrick psychological terror of like the whole ship turning against you.
Oh yeah,
like when he gets the man gets flogged, and then like he goes below deck to get a drink, and they're all like kind of like menacingly saluting him, and it's to a point where. I feel like that he started believing he was a Jonah himself. And that was the irony of there's a couple of really funny scenes too, because the relationship between Killick, the captain steward and the captain, like this Killick guy is so good at making coffee essentially and selecting wine, and making breakfast that the captain will forgive him almost any bad attitude that he gets like more as he gets fucking surly over the course, and they give a little bit of that, but when Jack's trying to open up this church service and he slides in the Bible cross and it's to Jonah chapter one and like the look that he gives Killick as he shuts the Bible, it's like that's really good.
Yeah,
but they also can make the solid point about like what these 19th century ideals of masculinity and command were.
And there's also just the idea that okay, maybe this guy can, make it to shore and live a different life,
Right.
Okay, he's not cut out for this, but maybe he can do something else. Well, guess what? You're out there. The thing they don't say is how long they're out there. They hint at it throughout the course of this movie, but I get the impression this movie takes place over a couple of years.
Maybe not. Certainly like a half a year, maybe.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't think years, because they also, like, they... that they mentioned that they can go 250, 300 miles a day. Like, they're surprisingly fast.
All right.
So, no, but they are on really super long voyages. But your point is, like, what is the prospect when, if this guy goes to London and he's 30-year-old midshipman, can he just go get another job? Can he go to the, you know, to the East India Tea Company to get, like, I don't know. Because it's the thing is, like, you know, back in the classicism and is in its full string, it was tough as a poor person to make it.
Still is.
Yeah, it still is. You know? But, like, back then, if you were in debt, they'd throw you in prison.
Oh, well, yeah.
I mean, they're starting to come bring that back stealth a little bit. Yeah. But, you know, it's like you go to debtor's prison and, like, well, when do I get out? Well, you can pay your debts. Well, how much
how
money am
I
making
money?
Here? Negative.
Yeah.
And in fact, you're slowly deteriorating health and social status. And it's like you're just fucked. So all that is in that, like, character, like, kind of baked into that character. Because I've seen this movie like 20 times and I've read the books, like, I'm on my second voyage through the books. And, like, you keep on – this is kind of a Godfatherian thing where you get a kind of a sense of the movie. But as you watch it again and again, you get to – you now start to really appreciate the finer points of it.
Yeah.
And there's still things that, like, I pick out that I hadn't noticed before, even on this watch.
Was, like, there something like that?
Yeah, like, I mean, I guess I've seen it a bunch of times, but, like, you hear the term, like, hull up or hull down when a guy is spotting a ship. And they actually show the Acheron hull down on the horizon where, due to the curvature of the Earth, you just see the tops of its mast, like it's emerging from the sea.
Huh.
And that's not something you
far it is
that's not something you think about, but and that's also proves the lie. Like, you know, a lot of people still to this day think that, like, no one knew the world was round until, like, Christopher Columbus fucking sailed to America. That's bullshit.
Yeah.
Like, as long as we've had mariners, people have known that the Earth is round because of that shit. Like, oh, I can see the top part of this ship when it's coming to me before I see the bottom. But I just noticed that they showed that in a telescope shot. I'm like, huh, fuck. I've never seen that for myself, but it was a really cool moment of verisimilitude or whatever they call it.
It's interesting that you mention Bettany, or what's his name?
Stephen Maturin. Yeah,
that he is a spy in the books, because they don't include that here in the movie. They make some passing reference to, oh, maybe there are spies in the ranks,
right?
But they don't say that he's a spy, and I very much got the impression that he was almost like suckered in by a good Navy recruiter speech. Like, oh, see the world, they said.
Right,
document new species, they said. No, you're not doing any of that. It was surprising to me how much he felt like almost a captive at places on this boat, at times.
And that is a little bit of the relationship. I don't say that Jack tricked him into it, but that's a tension, the fact that, like, Stephen at his heart is a scientist and a doctor. And the only reason he's in this war at all is because, like, because Stephen sees the world in shades of gray. Like, all forms of government are tyranny.
Mm-hmm.
But this Napoleon guy is especially bad because of, like, I haven't gotten to the background of why, you know, I guess it's because Napoleon was, like Stephen was all about the revolution. And even though he thought it was, like, horrific and the way it went down, that, like, you know, well, the people are governing. And then Napoleon came up and declared himself emperor. So he's, like, stealing one of the torches of liberty from the world. So, like, that made him Stephen's personal enemy. I forget where I was going with that. But, yeah, there's a lot of times where Stephen's, you know, goals as a natural starts thwarted by the Navy just, like, always hustling here and there. As soon as you get intelligence, if the tide is with you, then you sail. It doesn't matter, you know, what kind of awesome bat or mongoose is on shore that you want to look at.
Right. And speaking of that, oh, my God, this kid's drawings were cracking me up the whole time.
Right.
Like, really, that's your fucking turtle kid? You've got your crayons out and you're drawing your stupid turtles. Cracking me up the whole time. I loved it.
You got to start somewhere. I'm kind of glad that he wasn't doing a perfectly crosshatched, like, wood carving of a beetle. But I thought it was pretty sweet.
It was.
And it also showed, like, they don't really have a character like that in the books that's kind of like the joint son or child of both Stephen and Jack, where they're kind of like, and then I guess that was a pretty smart move because it kind of allowed them to do, he allowed that kid to do a lot of heavy relationship, but or heavy lifting for the relationship between Jack and Stephen. Cause even when they're on the outs, you know, he was like kind of the peacemaker between them.
Yeah. I feel like they're breeding like the Kirk, right?
Yeah,
a guy who's a little bit of both sides of, or maybe Picard's a better analogy here,
right?
Because Kirk is a little more fight,
or
a little more Jack, or
like I think they're directly trying to suggest that this is like, you know, this is how a person like Lord Nelson, who was famous for being able to motivate people, like you know, just extreme examples of like how this guy was able to motivate his men to do crazy dangerous things and come out victorious. And some of that is just like, you know, like Jack's name is Lucky Jack. Some of this is like you just are the beneficiary of a run of good luck that you didn't really deserve, but the men believe it. Like the men believe that you can be successful in any battle because you always have been. And some of that is just kind of doo-dah luck. but I like the fact that they address that. And in the books, they also address like what happens when that luck runs out. You know, because nobody can be successful and win every possible engagement. And, you know, when you've had your life like kind of been like charmed from the time you were a lieutenant and a young master and commander, what do you do when that when you get your first taste of adversity, both personal and career wise? That stuff is fascinating.
I do have a question about the end of this movie where they realize, oh, shit, the French captain pretended to be the doctor, and we put him on this ship bound for the shore.
Right, with only a lieutenant and a couple Marines to provide security.
Is that the problem? My question is, like, isn't he still a prisoner, and isn't he still going to, like, suffer the same fate that the captain would have? Or do they, like, execute captains or something?
No, they don't do that, but so they're, like, I think the idea is by posing as the doctor, a lot of times they would allow the opposing surgeon to assist because, like, you know, it's kind of like a mercy, a care thing. Like, you know, we all have wounded here. We need everybody to because it's a crapshoot. Like, fixing people up is like sometimes a guy with a scratch would fucking die and sometimes a guy who got his fucking brains half blown out would live. It's like it's all – essentially all Steven could do is patch you up and hope that you and treat your pain because they gave him this – you hear him refer to laudanum, which is essentially half brandy, half opium.
Okay.
That you could keep them comfortable and be as clean as you can, but you know, it's all relative. Like, you know, Steven, they show that he's not washing his hands between like this there's this guy beating a quarter or a pound sterling into a skull cap that he just takes from his grimy fingers and bolts it right to the guy's skull. Cuz they don't understand things about like I like that about Patrick O'Brien too, is that he doesn't make Steven superhuman.
Right.
Like he's like the peak woke doctor of his period.
Yeah.
But he still, like, you know, suffers from a lot of you know, they don't understand all the science behind it yet. He approaches it scientifically, but he doesn't know at all.
No, he kind of struck me as, you know, I think there's some very obvious parallels being drawn here as the Charles Darwin type, right? Like he still has the beliefs in God. He doesn't think like, oh, God, there's no such thing as God, and I'm going out to prove it.
I'm going to prove God wrong.
Right. He says, oh, yeah, certainly God had something to do with it, but also did they have something to do with it?
Right.
You know, as far as, like, changing themselves?
And then in him landing on the Galapagos approximately 25 years before Darwin, it's a fun, like, what if? Like, what if, you know, it allows you to imagine, like, oh, maybe like it's an slight alternate history where he writes the book on the origin of species instead of Darwin.
Yeah.
Which that's the other thing. It's like, my God, this is the first movie that got permission to film in the Galapagos Islands.
Right.
That's not to say there's not been like documentary films, but like them being able to, some of the most beautiful shots in the whole movie are the surprise is kind of gliding between the islands and the land. Like it's when you see the landscape of the Galapagos, you understand why like it was such an evolutionary hotbed because there's every type of terrain just stacked on top of each other and all these weird ass birds and iguanas of inhabiting these really unique niches that had all this weird selective pressure put on it. And also just the fact that like that you never see that, like, you know, the doctor comes and he's using his telescope. He's like, my God, two new species in as many minutes.
Yeah.
You can't do that nowadays.
No.
There was like literally things to discover in the world, which makes it that gives it that Star Trek feel.
Yeah. And it's why I feel just so sad for the doctor when they have to leave. You know, he doesn't get permission to just take his stroll across the island.
Right.
I feel really, really bad for him in that moment because that's all he wants.
Yeah, when you see there's like a real pain when you see Steven look behind him and there's all of his cages that he'd painstakingly assembled these specimens.
Yeah.
And what a... The other thing is, like, it really gives weight to, like, the wealth of science that he's going behind to pursue this, you know, yeah. belligerent expedition, as he calls it.
Mm-hmm.
It's great. It's great.
It is. Do you think Maturin ever gets to explore the Galapagos? I don't know if you've come across the finality of this part of his story.
Well,
so books,
that's the thing. Like, they did so much remixing of the different scenes. I can't remember... but he has, like, I mean, that's a big part of the novels, like, Steven's scientific explorations.
Yeah.
Like, he gets an adventure with, this crude diving bell. Like, he explores, like, a large part of the Amazon for the first time. And he's always bringing strange creatures that are freaking Jack and his men out. sometimes I love him. Like, there's an especially memorable point where he finds a sloth in Brazil. And the All hands, because right. the sloth would just sleep up in the rigging, and the men fucking loved it and thought he was a adorable thing. But then sometimes he'll try to bring a vampire bat on board.
Oh, no, no.
Or, like, it's not even a vampire. It's, like, it's because it's probably as big as like, a fruit bat. But the men, like, no fucking way are you bringing a demon on board.
Yeah.
No, That's the devil. It's literally the devil.
Speaking of sloths in the rigging,
some
of these people climbing around in this rigging, like, I can't believe how... incredibly dangerous it must have been to do this stuff.
Yeah.
Even just to operate the boat, right?
Yeah.
Like, some of those guys are just climbing around in their bare feet on ropes and sitting on the top of the mast shouting down to the crew.
Yeah.
It blew my mind.
And
to
then
see
doing
that
in 70-mile-an-hour winds.
Right, with 16-foot waves or whatever.
Yeah. You know, it is crazy.
Yeah.
And, I mean, yeah, just how dangerous that profession was back then.
Yep.
I think is intriguing, but also just like how kind of like mundane it was too. Cause like in between these things, they'd have these, you know, they just fucking get drunk and tell stories and,
swing in their hammocks.
Yeah. Or dance. Like the men would dance and sing on the deck. Cause it's, you know, a lot cooler there. And it was it's so fun. It's amazing to me in the 21st century, the internet and video games and golden age of television and Master Commander and Blu-ray, that people derive pleasure from clapping their hands, singing sea shanties, and dancing on the capstan, you know?
Uh-huh.
Like, oh, look at Nagel go. He's up there, and he's kicking up his jig. Whoa, boy. You know? And some of the deleted scenes show him racing goats. Like, they put, like, a flag of England around one and a flag of France, and they'd bet and do stupid shit, and they're tattooing each other. And But, just of being cooped up in that very small boat for months on end, eating shit food in utterly dangerous conditions. And some of them loved it.
And, you know, swinging around in the rigging, being completely drunk, too. That's the other thing that you...
They're all drinking a pint of rum
a day.
Yes, almost all the time. They're baseline madmen, except for their 100-foot in the air.
Yeah.
70-mile-an-hour wind.
Crazy. I'm really looking forward to Sea of Thieves, the game.
Yes.
Because this has got me with some renewed... interest in that game.
Yeah, it's just a type, like, that's the thing about modern games and simulators. They're just, you know, you're playing like Falcon and you're firing forget missiles from 100 away. It's not the same as like when you could do all these maneuvers and fake out people and, you know, get these small advantages in positioning and seamanship and gunnery. I'm excited too. I hope it captures all that.
Yeah, I think you're gonna have to be the crew captain because
I suck at it.
Maybe, but you'll at least know better than anyone else how to do it.
Depends on, that's the other thing. It's like, I wonder, like, how gamey they'll make it. Like, because I really like, what's the guy's name? Sid Meier's Pirates.
Mm-hmm.
Because I thought that's, like, really tactical, but you only have, like, you can essentially rig your sails, like, battle or full.
Yeah.
Or you can, like, do three different trim sails and control which way your boat points, and that's it. You know, and if that's the case, like...
I think it'll be pretty gamey, but the cooperation is the thing
I'm
excited about.
Yeah. All right. What else do we want to talk about?
That's all I've got, which is why I pivoted to Sea of Thieves.
All right. I want to make a pitch on reading the books. Because these are, like, my favorite books series of all time. But I also, it's one of those things where I don't think they're for everyone. Because it's just... like, if you didn't like this movie, then fucking keep moving, because I don't think you'll like the books, because the books are very, very well represented in the movies, or in the movie. But I guess the pitch on it is like it's just such a realistic depiction of the life and the world, and these characters are so good, and there's so many touching things that I don't want to spoil a lot, but I want to like talk about the, like the rare payoffs. Like for example, in the third book, there's this he's got this really dry sense of humor. He's got this joke that he sets up with this sloth. That is like 100 pages of buildup of like Steven bringing the sloth on board and the men loving the sloth. But for whatever reason, every time the sloth sees Jack, he hides his face in Steven's chest and bawls. And like it's like Jack may and that bothers Jack because Jack's this friendly, gregarious guy. And it really bothers him when people don't like him because he's like, everyone likes me. What the fuck is wrong? So he starts feeding this sloth bits of biscuit soaked in rum. And progressively gets the sloth, like, fucking drunk. And there's, like, this climax where Steven finds out that he's debauched his sloth and they have this giant fight that, like, I had to put the book down and wipe tears out of my eyes because it was 100 pages of buildup for this stupid drunken sloth joke. And then there's this also this Moriarty, like Sherlock Holmes battle between Steven Matron, this intelligence agent, and a very highly placed spy in the command center of the Navy that lasts like 10 books. And it kind of climaxes because this guy's like working for Jack's downfall. And it climaxes in the 11th book. And the end of that is like one of the most moving like depictions of like brotherhood and fraternity I've ever seen. And then Steven's eventual, when he discovers this guy's identity and his eventual revenge, like he uses every bit of his political and espionage skill to break this guy, have him killed in some third world country, and then fucking buys his body and dissects him. Like, that's some cold shit. You don't see Sherlock Holmes didn't beat Moriarty and then fucking dissect him for some kind of medical textbook.
Avon Barksdale didn't even do that shit.
Yeah, like, it's some cold, it's some ice, and like, you're like, holy shit, don't fuck with Steven. Yeah. And that's the other thing is they show a little bit of that in the movie too. Like Steven's actually an expert swordsman and duelist.
Yeah, I was surprised by
that. They just bust that out. You wouldn't expect that from him. But like it's one of the quiet pleasures of the book is anytime someone calls Steven out in a duel, it's like, oh, this guy's gonna get fucked up.
Yeah.
It's sword pistol doesn't matter.
It's like the nerd who's been practicing jiu-jitsu for 30 years, right?
Right.
You see him, oh, he's look at this nerd.
Right. Right.
Start picking on him, he tears your arms off.
Exactly. Or he's like the elderly Asian man with the right. flowing long white hair. And he's just like, no, he's just going to give you the five palm monkey heart exploding technique and you're going to die. But I've never seen anything like it. That's realistic. And there's also a lot more, it's not a surprising amount of female friends because. The second book they say is Patrick O'Brien's like love letter to Jane Austen.
Okay.
It's very Sense and Sensibility, Pride and Prejudice, because it's all about Stephen and Jack courting these women and their relationship, and that becomes their families become an important part of the books as the series goes on. It's interesting because their character development is much slower because like Jack and Steven will be at sea for 18 months.
Right.
And then it's like, oh, look at the kids grown and here's what's going on with the wife and household. But there's like a lot of pathos is generated between those characters. And it's just, like I said, it's just a very realistic depiction of like several dozen characters that you really get to care about over the course of 20 books. And then it ends and like Patrick O'Brien literally dies in the middle of writing the 21st book.
And Brandon Sanderson takes over.
And I actually the 21st book is called 21. And I've said this before, but like it starts off like three or four chapters of actually typed out manuscript. And then there's like a chapter and a half of like his handwritten notes that they photocopied. And it devolves into a picture like, I guess Patrick O'Brien would to set up scenes. He would like draw a dinner table and like show where all the characters were sitting. And then there's like sketches of a battle that was going to happen later in the book. And it just like ends in the middle of the adventure, which felt right to me. It's kind of like these are the continuing and it's just going to end in the middle. And Jack and Steven are always going to be sailing. It never is going to come to an end.
Yeah.
But also you got 20 and a half books out of him. What more did you want?
So that's a published book.
Yeah, it's called
21.
It's called 21: The Unfinished Voyages of Aubrey and Maturin.
Yeah, I guess it is very much like, you know, their continuing mission to pull to go. Yeah,
it's weird because the 20th book kind of like is a good stopping point too.
Right.
But he just apparently he felt motivated to write one more tale or two, and he just died in the middle of it. So what are you going to do? He's an old man.
Yeah.
The other thing that's interesting about Patrick O'Brien is that like I've recently come to learn that he's kind of a shit person. He was terrible to his first wife and his children. Like, you know, like just a terrible human being, an unlikable, bitter, you know, indecent man. And it's so interesting that a person like that can write about love and like duty and courage and brotherhood in a way that's so inspiring, but his personal example is just like there's nothing even close to it.
Yeah,
that's very it's interesting to the classic, can you enjoy an artist's art if he's like a terrible human being? And I don't think Patrick O'Brien raped anybody or killed anybody, but he's just an asshole.
Yeah, I mean, some people write about write the idealized version of what they think these things are versus the reality of love and the reality of being a good father and husband and whatnot. Like,
right.
I'm sure they're very different, right? Like what you see on the screen, what you read in books is fictionalized and it's fantastic and it's, idealized in a lot of ways.
It's the person he wanted to be, but maybe just couldn't because of whatever demons he faced.
Yeah,
because
it's much harder to actually be that than to write about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think a fair number of authors are kind of like that.
All right. Because he's also like, there's other things like, Patrick O'Brien would be very liberal by, 1805 standards.
Oh, and God, I would hope so.
And you can see a little bit of that in, like, Jack and Stephen. Like, they're more fair. They're probably, I don't think they're, like, anachronistically fair-minded.
Mm-hmm.
But in many circumstances, they're amongst the most, like, when it deals to, like, sometimes Patrick O'Brien rightfully so gets on his moral high horse when you're talking about, like, the American slave trade. In fact, like slavery had been outlawed in Britain for a long time, and like black and whites in the Royal Navy were wasn't a lot of like racism in the Navy because they're integrated and they're
You do see a couple of black people in this movie, but just a couple.
Right, there wasn't a lot of discrimination amongst the men about that. And there's a couple other there's some funny things like they're in the South Pacific and they get. Stephen and Jack get shipwrecked and they get picked up by you don't understand because they're all speaking in a different language, but it's essentially some Polynesian women who got sick of their men, killed them all, and then took to the sea in the ship. It's just women.
Boy.
And then they find these two shipwrecked white men and just put them through hell.
I bet.
And it's like just leads to a scene where they're about I think that they're about to cut Stephen and Jack's dick off, and Stephen I forget how he uses a little linguistic trick to like bamboozle them somehow and avoid that fate, but pretty funny.
Sounds cool.
If you're at all curious, I think if you read the first book and you like it, but you're just concerned about how heavy going to sea stuff is, I would say keep reading. If you're through the first book and you're like, I don't get it at all, then you can stop. And if you didn't like the movie, then fuck it. You're not gonna like the books. But they're my favorite. In fact, my son, his first and middle name is Jack Aubrey.
Right.
Because I feel like I'm much more like Stephen Maturin, but I want to be more like Jack.
Okay.
So that's a little aspirational. It turns out my son's also a Stephen.
Well, you need to find a Jack Aubrey to pair up with and teach your son to be like the ultimate synthesis.
There you go. I don't know how many Russell Crowe Jack Aubreys are there.
Maybe you can just ask Russell Crowe.
Yeah.
To help tutor your child.
Come fight around the world to Cincinnati right. And spend a couple summers over here. Russell Crowe's Seamanship Academy.
I have a feeling Russell Crowe's not a great role model. Russell Crowe the man.
Yeah.
Russell Crowe the characters, maybe.
The other thing I want to end on is like a lot when people ask me what HBO should adapt into some kind of series or what I'd most like to see, I either say the Dresden Files, but I really think that you could make a 5 or 6 epic season run with a Game of Thrones-ish budget with the right cast and crew. And it's a damn shame because other than Billy Boyd as the captain's coxswain Bonden, I thought that everyone was cast like impeccably. And the only reason I like that is because The book Bonden is a much bigger, strapping badass than I associate with a fucking hobbit.
Okay.
That's just kind of stunt casting. But you'd have to cast it right. You'd have to get the person that would bring the historical accuracy to it and like to respect the material, like Peter Weir obviously did.
Mm-hmm.
Because Peter Weir, like do you know his filmography much?
No.
So I'm gonna go in order of least likely for you to recognize to most likely. The Last Wave, that might ring a bell because it got
the Australian Outback film, right?
That had the David Gilpilly, Aboriginal guy, that was a lot of inspiration for some of season two and season three's The Leftovers action.
Mm-hmm.
Mosquito Coast.
Okay, I've heard of it.
That's a Harrison Ford vehicle. Then Witness, which was the Amish one.
That's not the one with River Phoenix.
Yes,
okay, I've
is.
Seen that one then.
Yep.
Yeah.
Witness, Dead Poet Society.
I haven't seen that.
The Truman Show.
Sure.
Peter. So he's pretty good. And like some of these things, like The Truman Show, he's got this talent of like this really constrained storytelling.
Yeah.
You know, because like this Master and Commander, like this all takes place on a fucking tiny boat, relatively speaking.
Mm-hmm.
Truman Show takes place in this enclosed dome. And yet, like, it's a fully realized world.
Yeah.
So I also wanted to – Stephen S. had a little bit of feedback that I wanted to get to.
Okay.
Says, Master and Commander is close to my heart. I grew up boating and going fishing around South Florida. When I was younger, my father and I would go fishing offshore anywhere from 10 to 40 miles. Being out in the open ocean in search of fish to catch and eat led to a lot of bonding with my dad. I remember being seasick and throwing up multiple times when it was rough. I'm pretty seasick myself. Hiding under the center console when I would get scared, getting caught in storms and rough seas. The excitement and adrenaline when you have a fish on the line and the feeling of accomplishment if you were able to get the fish in the boat still surprises me every time.
Shitting off the front of the boat.
Shitting off the head.
Yeah.
These are some of the most vivid memories when my younger brother was old enough to get I got to experience him having these experiences for the first time. Life, work, and the world can get me feeling down, and there's nothing that cheers me up like being in the ocean.
Hmm.
I guess it's my version of being in a remote forest and connecting to nature while reminiscing on life. That's one of the reasons why my dream of retirement is to be on like a 30-foot sailboat, because it is kind of the only sovereign territory you can have.
Sure.
Because you get offshore and like you're essentially your own fucking government at that point.
Yeah.
Monkey fights, drug running. It's all there. All there.
Yep.
Just grab a dolphin and eat it.
Getting sloss drunk.
and also, like, there's life because, you know, that's also still a vulnerable thing. Like, a big storm on a 30-foot sailboat will fuck you up.
Sure.
When I first saw this movie in 2009, I was 19 and it related to me like no other movie had. Jack's search for the friendship, the difficult conditions on the water and aboard the ship, the bonding and camaraderie, the unrelenting might of the ocean, the absolute beauty of it. The sacrificing for the greater good. I don't think this movie is perfect, but I don't think it matters to me. So thank you for that, Stephen S. And Moz Beat, I consider it like a personal gift to me that you guys commissioned this film.
He said it's not perfect. I can't think of a way I'd make it better.
Like I said, I can think of like there's a few. I think like the. Jack getting inspiration from the study of science for his naval ruse bothers me, but that's only something a book reader or someone that's steeped in the history of sailing would say.
Yeah.
I don't like the casting of Billy Boyd, and also I thought the guy making a model of the ship was dumb because like I don't really think
that didn't really help.
No, but it was something for the audience to explain like why this ship has got wired cannonballs bound. I mean, it's very economical.
I thought there was going to be some like physical trait of the boat that allowed him to defeat it with we got to shoot it in the
reactor
in the front instead of the back. But that didn't come to pass.
And the other thing is, and I noticed this in the deleted scenes, they did a lot better job of like leading up to the Marine shooting Steven, because that was something they came into conflict time and time again. This guy would just shoot animals for sport, and it pissed Steven off because he's like, if the men can't eat it and I can't dissect it, why are you killing it? And he's like, because I just like to fucking hunt. He's like this Gaston character. And then that led to his downfall when he, you know, they came to direct heads and, you know, Steven got shot in the gut.
Yeah, I still felt like it was handled well in the film.
Yeah.
Like, even though it was just kind of out of nowhere, it was chaotic on deck and this thing's swooping down.
Right.
and Steven was just in the wrong place.
I just felt like it gave a little bit more. I know, like I said, I'm
yeah. The books are more of everything, right?
Like, yeah. And if I had like these were deleted scenes, so I'm guessing like this movie's already 2.5 hours long. So like that was only like probably a minute of scene that I thought actually would have made that moment a little bit more deep. Because a lot of the characters start to get pretty thin once you get up from Jack and Steven. And like Blakely and they start getting pretty thinly, and especially the Marine captain I think came off as pretty thin, whereas that
a little
gave,
like Mace Tyrell to me.
that gave him a little bit more things to do and a little bit more relationship between him and the doctor that would let up more emotional weight. But yeah, it's a pretty fucking good movie.
It is. It's great.
And I also, the people, like, I just can't believe how many fucking this is the same thing as Game of Thrones. Like, you get people to read the novels and, like, the fucking series is just shit. And, but, like, I just felt like a lot of the critiques I saw from Patrick O'Brien fans were very thin. Like, the guy's tearing him an asshole for changing, the timeline so they're not at war with America. It's like, O'Brien... He hustled through the first 12 years of the Napoleonic War in like the first 12 books and realized, oh shit, I still want to tell a lot more stories about Jack and Steven, but the war's going to be over.
Yeah.
So like the next 6 books take place in this like eternal summer of 1813. Like years worth of action happened in 3 months because he doesn't give a fuck. Like in the Ford Everett book, he's like, yeah, I'm fucking with the time. I got to tell the story. Deal with it. And, like, if the author himself does something like that to better serve the story, then who are you to tell Peter Weir that it's inappropriate for him to change the timeline to better appeal to his audience?
Yeah, and is that something that you tore Patrick O'Brien a new one for?
No, clearly
not. Of course
not.
You love the book. So if he's taking liberties, let the movie take
it. And I also love these guys saying, like, oh, they didn't nail the relationship between Steven and Jack. Like,
I disagree.
Fucking read the first book, and if you think that like that first book... Their relationship is not nearly as deep or broad or anything as it is at the end of book 20. Because, of course, it's not. There's 7,000 more fucking pages to go, you asshole.
Right.
I get really upset when people I feel like it's some of these. It's often goes without saying that the book version of whatever is the superior version.
Mm-hmm.
But people that can't get past, and there's bad adaptations and good adaptations, but people that savage good adaptations, like people that nitpick Lord of the Rings, and not in a fan-friendly way, but just in people that like this are fucking plebes and watered-down, unwashed, fucking toothless idiots. It's like a really pet peeve of mine.
It's all about the order you consume them in as well, right? Like,
true.
If you were to go watch this movie and then go, holy shit, that was great, and rightfully so, I want to read the books. Then you'd go, holy shit, the movie is great, but the books are also great.
Right.
You wouldn't be like, oh, these books are total bullshit. They do so much more than the movie. Why?
Yeah.
Like.
Yeah. But yeah, HBO, they need to make devote like $60-80 million a season. And you get 5 or 6 seasons. I think it would be a hit. Although,
it'd be a hit with me.
Yeah, I think it would make a lot of money, get a lot of viewers. But then again, their last historical dramas haven't done so well. Like, Vinyl got shit canned.
Oh, yeah.
Boardwalk Empire never really got as successful as they want it to be.
Yeah.
The Nick was so-so for Cinemax. So maybe they just feel like period. Maybe that's a problem. Period piece. People just don't like period pieces.
Yeah.
But then Titanic's like the number one movie in the world, right? Or second?
It's pretty big, yeah.
Yeah. So, but that's a love story, and this is at best if you read the right fanfics, a homoerotic love story. but on plain reading, it's just it's a brotherly love story.
Yeah.
So, that's all I got. It's a great movie. I hope you guys enjoy it. Thank you for indulging me on this probably long ass movie review.
Yeah.
And I'd love to talk with people about it on the forums.baldmove.com if you want to talk more about that. Do you know what we have coming up, Jim?
I don't.
I feel like we got a real run. Oh my god. We got Reservoir Dogs, Batman Begins, Doctor Strangelove, the next 3 movies coming up. That's a murderer's row, man.
Nice.
So you got that coming forward in the weeks ahead, as well as Game of Thrones, a little show you might have heard of. Speaking of period pieces, we'll see you on the next one. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.